Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the kind words. And I will immediately start because I have only 50 minutes, I suppose, and it is a very huge domain. The title covers indeed a very huge domain because of the exceptional dimensions of this correspondence in terms of writers, extant items and topics discussed. This has all to do with the strategic position correspondence held within the Jesuit society right from the beginning. Indeed, already Ignatius of Loyola understood the potential role of a periodic, comprehensive and well-regulated correspondence between the central institution of the society and the members themselves in a rapidly developing society with a top residing in Rome and members dispersed over the world, to creating a real corporation and a corporative identity as a kind of substitute for the absence of a common spiritual life. This original intuition was further implemented by João Polanco and refined in the constitutions, which quite precisely described and prescribed the internal system of reporting and the circulation of these reports from the bottom, the individual residences, via the provincial authorities to the top authorities, the general and his five assistants in Rome, who in their turn summarized, selected and redistributed the information through copies to the other Jesuit provinces. I will not dwell further on this general point, as this is well described, for instance, in the contribution of Antonella Romano and Luce Giard, which I took here as the starting point of the following observations. I just want to stress first that in this Jesuit communication network, from the very beginning, special attention was paid to the more remote areas where the Jesuits were active, such as the missions in the West and East Indies. Besides, as far as the letters also reported on scholarly or learned activities of the society's priests, this same network also contributed largely to create a Jesuit scientific culture or a Jesuit science, as was stressed by Stephen Harris and O'Malley. This appropriation of a regular correspondence for scientific purposes already started with the first professional scientist of the society, the mathematician Christophorus Clavius, who practiced the communication by letters as an instrument to shape his ideas, to get the books he needed, and to distribute afterwards his own publications, also to China, where one of his pupils, Matteo Ricci, founded, so to speak, the mission in the beginning of the 17th century. In all these respects, Jesuit scholarly correspondence from China during the almost two centuries of the society's presence in China, from Matteo Ricci, who arrived in Beijing in 1601, to the suppression of the same society in 1773, is a most representative, though extreme, illustration of this type of communication inside and outside the society. Extreme by the distance and its consequences, by its exceptional contents, by the intricate network which spanned from China almost whole Europe, including not Catholic areas such as Russia and the United Kingdom, extreme also by the great number of extant letters and the wide dispersal after the suppression over all possible and more than once also impossible public and private collections in Europe. I have to return on all these aspects in a few minutes. Before continuing, I should probably briefly describe my own position in the study of Jesuit correspondence, as it determines, of course, the following observations. Although directly involved in the edition of at least one individual epistolary corpus, that of Ferdinand Verbeest, my interest in Jesuit letters from China concerns in principle the complete corpus of Jesuit letters from China, but this from an instrumental point of view. First, my interest concerns the letters as sources with regard to the activities of the Jesuit astronomers and mathematicians in China, especially, but not only, Ferdinand Verbeest, the circulation of Astronomica and other evidence of these activities to 17th, 18th century Europe and the reception there. Second, my project in progress, bearing on the desire of the Jesuits for up-to-date Western books in China and their methodical building up of Western libraries, brought me to an even more systematic hunting of letter collections in Europe, as the letters from China are my main source. Only the fact that these letters give information on more than 1,300 book titles, of which about one-fourth explicitly on science, on the circumstances of their circulation from Europe to China and within China, and on the way these were actually manipulated, consumed and assimilated, is a first proof of the substantial contribution of this kind of learned correspondence for a more in-depth and refined view on the intercultural undertaking which the Jesuit mission in China was. Against this background, I will present first some distinctive characteristics of the correspondence from China, proceeding then second to a short identification of the historical communication and transfer routes, and three, an overview of the correspondence, four, an inventory of the themes, five, the present locations of the main collections, to finish six with a presentation of some major individual collections, and seven, their impact on the contemporary European public, with a global assessment as a source for 17th century European and world history. Okay. This is the menu. The first point then, this correspondence from China distinguishes itself from the more common Jesuit correspondences, of course, obviously, by one extra inconvenience, the extraordinary distance between Europe and China, traditionally calculated in Chinese as 90,000 or even 100,000 li. This has, of course, had several consequences. First, the distance indeed implies a long time span, with an average of about 2 years. That makes 4 years in both directions in the first half of the 17th century. To about 8 months between Amsterdam or Paris and southern China since the beginning of the 18th century. For the evidence, I refer to my observations in an article on the tyranny of distance forthcoming in the Bulletin of Portuguese-Japanese Studies this year. A second consequence, this distance over sea brought along with it a much greater risk of losses in via underway. By precautions and prescription, at least more important letters were made or sent in manifold copies. This explains why in European collections several, but rarely precisely identical copies of one and the same letters are to be found. A third consequence, in most cases the incoming mail, I mean the letters which were sent from Europe to the Jesuits in China, are almost all lost. Therefore, we have an incomplete and incoherent or discontinuous view of the correspondance suivie between several correspondents in Europe and China, and vice versa, which is only very partially compensated by the references to the incoming mail received, which is one of the prescribed points in the opening sentences of the response letter. A fourth consequence, the defective and time-consuming communication affected the decision-making, both in Europe and in China, as letters crossed each other, or were delayed or wholly lost in via. Of course, it also seriously affected an efficient scientific communication. Yet, still in 1623, Johann Schreck, Latinate Terentius, keep this name in mind, advised his learned correspondent, the physician Johann Faber in Rome, to communicate new findings or observations in the domain of physics of astronomy, by preference through letters rather than by shipping newly published books, as books arrived still later and were mostly susceptible to loss, also by theft. Obviously, letters were not the only form of scientific communication between China and Europe. This was also completed and refined viva voce during the periodical personal visits of the mission procurators to Rome and Europe. I will return to this point in a few minutes. But now I come to the second point concerning the routes. of the routes this letter communication used, I should mention at least 6 overseas and 2 overland. Overseas routes were especially the Via Goana, the traditional one, from Lisbon over Goa to Macau. The Via Batavica, from Macau over Batavia to Amsterdam and vice versa. The Via Gallica from Brest or Port Louis and Pontichéry to Canton. The Via Mexicana, also called Americana, from Sevilla through Acapulco and the Philippines to Macau. The Via Anglicana and, very ephemeral but efficient, the Via Ostendana, the line between Ostend in Belgium and Canton in 1718 until 1728. Already in the 17th century, overland routes were also tested, either via the Middle East and Persia and the Silk Road, or, and mostly, by the Via Moscovitica or the Via Siberica, using the 3 yearly Trans-Siberian caravans from Moscow to Beijing and vice versa. This happened the first time in 1730. Apart from these via, several occasional intersections were used and new branches exploited. Thus, for instance, the network which connected London and Paris with Lisbon and St. Petersburg, this since the second quarter of the 18th century, in which several Portuguese scholars working in academic circles abroad played a substantial role. The preferences for one of these routes show a clear evolution following the technological advances in one or other country and the international political situation, or taking immediate advantage of the rise of new, albeit ephemeral, opportunities, such as the Verenigde Oostendse Compagnie in the period 1718-1728. Generally speaking, since the capture of Malacca by the Dutch, and especially since the 1660s, the Jesuits of the Portuguese mission preferred to entrust their mail to the Dutch VOC, despite the religious objections, because of the time saved. Other specializations were the Via Siberica, which became frequently used in the 1720s and 30s after the Academy of St. Petersburg was founded, and soon made contact with the missionaries in Beijing for an exchange of information. On all these routes, many particular places and persons worked as reliable contacts and turning points. In the long story of the China-Europe mail communications, this was in the first place, of course, Macau and the Jesuit Collegium Madre de Deus, which had also a multiplication effect, thanks to the work of the local amanuenses. In Batavia, it was, in the last decades of the 17th century, the Protestant minister Theodorus Sachs, who died in 1704, who collected in return for his services towards the Jesuits a lot of Sino-Jesuit papers, which later constituted the first corpus of Sinica, entering the Leiden University Library. In Europe, I think of a central Jesuit scholar such as Athanasius Kircher, who died in 1680 in the Collegio Romano in Rome. I think also of benefactors or benefactresses like Maria de Guadalupe, Duchess of Aveiro. The printer family Moretus of the Officina Plantiniana in Antwerp, where I found a small corpus of about 25 China letters, from where Jesuit correspondence from China was dispatched over the rest of Europe. I think also of an interested outsider such as Leibniz, especially after his meeting with the Jesuit Grimaldi, who returned from China and was in Rome in 1689. I think of Etienne Soucier, librarian of the Collège Louis le Grand, who died in 1744, and main correspondent and book provider of Antoine Gobile and his French colleagues in Beijing. And so on. I can think of the Portuguese physician Antonio Ribeiro Sanchez, who died in 1783 in St. Petersburg, the professed house in Antwerp with the Bollandist fathers, and so on. These networks were not, of course, online connections. I mean that they relied on personal contacts, commitments, responsibilities. One must, in these cases, I suppose, look for the origin of these personal links. And they are often to be found in the formation period of the missionary or in various situations of what is called solidarité régionale. I refer here to the small networks of local or regional character which kept Jesuits in China in contact with old Jesuit fellow students, the condiscipuli, of the same Jesuit college, or former friends from their native area. or simply relatives. Such regional networks linked, for instance, Prospero in Torcetta to the Jesuit College of the Collegio Massimo in Palermo and several Sicilian noble families. These connections become not only visible for us in letters from China to Palermo, but also, even on the doctrinal questions, but also in the exchange of books with dedications found both in Beijing and in Palermo. These networks linked, for instance, also several Jesuits in China to the Collège Sainte Trinité in Lyon. Famous Jesuits working in China for 40 years, like Henri Régis, Parrain de Mayan. Also here, letters were accompanied by manuscripts and books preserved until now in the Baitang collection in Beijing and in Lyon. Networks which linked, for instance, Jesuits from China to the Jesuit College of Bourges in France. Others linked Jesuits from China to München, to Antwerp, and so on. This brings me to the third point, a further discussion of the range of correspondence of these letters in Europe. Obviously, there was to some extent an internal communication between the Jesuits in China itself, also on learned topics, which comprised observations, instruments, comments on books and so on, but only very rare examples of these are preserved, such as, for instance, to give just one example, the 1684 letter of Ferdinand Verbist to Antoine Thomas in Macao on geodetic questions and the measuring of the height of mountains from a distance. But almost all the other correspondents were Jesuits living in Europe and were either Jesuits themselves or, especially since the late 1680s and on a more general scale in the 18th century, lay people as well, benefactors, male or female, scholars, academics from London, Paris, Lisbon to St. Petersburg. Already in the 1620s, the German Jesuit Johann Schreck, himself an ex-member of the Accademia dei Lincei, corresponded from China on a professional basis with Galileo Galilei on the Chinese calendar and its astronomical basis, letters which remained unanswered, and with Johann Kepler, giving the impetus to the publication of their common Epistolium ex regno sinarum ad mathematicos europaeos missum cum commentationcula Johannes Kepler in Mathematici, published in Sagan in Silesia in 1613. With the physician also, his letters also with the physician Johann Faber in Rome, with the chemist Oswald Crollius in Prague, the mathematician Ziegler in Frankfurt am Main, who was also his contact with the Frankfurt Buchmesse, the Jesuit mathematicians of Ingolstadt, including Christopher Scheiner. But apart from Terentius, it was especially from the end of the 17th and the early 18th century that the Jesuits had more and more private contacts with scholars and academies, so that when we keep the whole corpus of letters in view, the 1680s, 1690s appear as a kind of watershed, with the earlier generations of Jesuits only casually speaking of their scientific projects, with the exception of the ex-Lincei and Johann Terentius, while the professional, learned correspondences start mainly since the arrival of the French mathematician Du Roy in 1687, with a concentration in the first three quarters of the 18th century. One could consider Antoine Thomas as a transition figure, referring to some revealing letters as his manuscript Epistola Astronomica of 1682, in which he reports in detail on his comet observations in Ayutthaya in Siam, comparing and correcting the data he found in Ptolemy in Julius Schiller Coelum Stellatum of 1627 and Johann Bayer Uranometria, books which he had at his disposal in Siam and in China. Reflecting on the possible reasons for this difference between the former generations and the generations since the late 17th, early 18th century, this altered position of learning may cover a changed level of professionalism of the candidates for the China mission, even when it is difficult to point out what precisely may have been the difference between the level of instruction of, for instance, the Bohemian Wenceslas Pantaleon Kirwitzer, former mathematical teacher at the Jesuit College of Graz, Austria, or Adam Eichenlehr, his colleague in the late 1660s in Ingolstadt, both recruits for the China mission, who unfortunately died in Via, and on the other hand, Ignaz Köchler, former mathematical teacher in Ingolstadt, and since 1770, head of the Astronomical Bureau in Beijing. Kirwitzer left only a few letters and observational results. Köchler, on the contrary, 100 years later, left a series of letters to his fellow fathers in Bavaria, all more or less involved in scholarly activities, letters which are dense of source references, questions, arguments and discussions, as we will see. Also, the scholarly activities and the connected correspondence of the first generation of the French Jesuits, which arrived in China in 1687, are directly related to their official commitment in the name of King Louis XIV and the Académie de France, and the following generation too, with Antoine Goupil as an apogee. They all were primarily active as real scholars. Not only a more professional formation, and not to forget the support of better equipped libraries, but also the external circumstances will have been of some influence. I mean, the almost inexistent missionary activities and the absence of institutional obligations towards the Sino-Manchu emperor, which left the French, contrary to the Portuguese, much more free to do research for observations, measurements and the time-consuming study of Chinese classics or other learned publications. When thus the direct contacts with European academies were systematized, it were especially the French Académie des Sciences and Académie des Inscriptions et des Belles-Lettres in Paris, the Royal Society in London, the Academia Curiosorum Naturae in Schweinfurt Halle, the Academia Imperialis in St. Petersburg, and a series of Italian academies which were involved. Not that these contacts were always easy, and more than once we read in the letters from the French Jesuits in China how disappointed they are about the answers which remained forthcoming, and even in the case of a positive reaction, they were doubtful about how serious their work had been taken into consideration within the French academic circles. On the other hand, also issues of the proceedings of the respective academies were circulating to China with many interruptions and much delay, and were also used as a source of information on new findings, new instruments and books recently published, so that these became, together with the letters, one of the main instruments which contributed to the circulation of new ideas from Europe to China. These epistolary contacts lasted until the very end of the Jesuit mission and the Society's suppression in 1773, and even later, albeit as ex-Jesuits, until the former Portuguese college Nantang, then under Lazarist supervision, was closed in 1812. Here I should briefly discuss a special category of letters, the correspondence which were attracted, so to speak, by the mission procurators, whom I already mentioned, and who periodically arrived in Europe and Rome. Certainly the primary purpose of their visits, which sometimes spent a complete decade, concerned the mission's position and a series of related diplomatic or organizational aspects of the same. But they were at the same time intensively and more or less methodically searching for funds, new recruits, books, instruments and other scholarly information. The most suggestive names here are, in chronological order, Nicolas Trigault, who was in Europe in 1616 until 1618, Martino Martini, the author of the Novus Atlas Sinensis, which in 1654 and 1655 brought for the first time Chinese geography and also ancient pre-Christian Chinese history directly from the original sources to the European scholars and also merchants. The Polish Michael Boehm, the Italian Prospero Intercetta, the Fleming Philippe Couplet, who was in Europe between late 1683 and 1691, the Italian Claudio Filippo Grimaldi, who was in Europe in 1689 until 91, and the Belgian François Noël, who was in Europe since between 1701 and 1705. During their temporary stay in Europe, they brought Chinese books, and own manuscript compositions on China in circulation or publish them, such as the aforementioned Atlas, or the Confucius Scenario Philosophus, published in 1687 in Paris, which introduced three of the basic Confucian classics to Europe. In turn, they collected here books and instruments for their colleagues, scholars in China. But especially, they visited many local scholars or started a lively correspondence with them, and thus became for a while the center of a small network of contacts informing on Chinese language, Chinese philosophy, religion, policy, and so on, which not rarely were continued by letter also later when they left Europe and returned to China. As a more precise example, I will focus here on two visiting procurators in particular, I mean Philippe Couplet and Claudio Filippo Grimaldi. Especially from Paris, where he stayed in 1686 and 1688, Philippe Couplet maintained an intense correspondence and more direct contacts with such different authorities as his former Condes Cipolus, the Bollandist Daniel Papa Brogius, famous hagiographist, with the Orientalist and theologian Louis Picquet of the Sorbonne, with Jean Hardouin, with Eusebe Renaudot, Orientalist as well, with the German proto-Sinologist Christian Menzel and Andreas Müller, with the mathematician Christian Huygens, the burgomaster of Amsterdam Nicolas Witsen, who prepared his magisterial compilation Noord en Oost Tartarije, the Swedish antiquarian and linguist Johan Gabriel Sparrenfeld, Melchizedek Thévenot, librarian of the Bibliothèque du Roi in Paris, the royal confessor François Dex de la Chaise, the mission procurator Antoine Verjus, his factotum, and the man with a far-reaching network of contacts also in Germany and Italy, with the printers and booksellers of the Officina Plantiniana in Antwerp and those of the Rue Saint-Jacques in Paris, and so on. Extensions of his network reached as far as the Vatican librarian Emmanuel Schelstraete in Rome, also a former condiscipulus of the Leuven Jesuit College, and through his Chinese companion Michael Shen Fuzhong, also to Thomas Heide in Oxford. Thomas Heide engaged the Chinese in the Bodleian Library to describe and classify the approximately 70 Chinese books on the stack, but received from him also a lot of first-hand sinological information, which is preserved partially in his manuscripts now in the British Library, but also in his posthumously published Syntagmata Dissertationum. Last but not least, he received some Latin written letters from him, still preserved in the British Library. It is clear that in the several cross and intersections, such as the letters between Heide and Louis Picquet in Paris, or Menzel and Schelstraete and so on, the information on China and the Jesuit writings on Chinese themes were further transmitted at second or third hand, so that we can indeed speak of a real circulation of information and a living and productive network of contacts. A second example, thus far less systematically studied, of a learned procurator is Claudio Filippo Grimaldi, who in 1689 until 1691, on his tour from Lisbon over Rome, Bologna, Florence, Munich, Warsaw, Krakow, Wroclaw, Vienna, Genova, Paris and Marseille, had many personal meetings, including the one, the famous one, with Leibniz in Rome, but also with some Jesuit mathematicians from the Collegio Romano, members of the Accademia Physico-Mathematica in Rome, especially Francesco Esquinardi and Antonio Baldigiani. Meetings also with Filippo Bonanni, librarian of the Roman Professed House and also keeper of the famous Museum Kircherianum. Meetings with the Jesuit Mathematicus Regius of Jan III Sobieski, Adam Adamandus Kosansky, himself the center of an entire archipelago of connections and letters, as was recently proven by the new edition of his letters by Bordan Lisiak. Meetings also with the Jesuit Architectus Regius of Jan III Sobieski, Stanislav Solski. Certainly also with the Franco-Italian water engineers Francini, whose hydraulic realizations he had admired in the gardens of Versailles and so on. Most of these contacts were not only described in other correspondences, but were afterwards also continued by letter, although the still largely incomplete census of Grimaldi's letters does not allow us to be too explicit here. So, but now it is time, I suppose, to go over to my fourth point. What were the topics of this huge correspondence from China with Europe? It is almost impossible, obviously, to give in a nutshell a relevant overview of the entire range of topics reported on in these letters, which were also advised, if not prescribed, by the Jesuit rules. Rarely were scholarly and other topics described separately, so that most letters had mixed contents. I mention, not necessarily in order of importance, first among the non-scholarly topics, topics such as the state of the mission, the general, especially political situation of the Chinese Empire, occasionally also on the military and economic aspects of the same, the attitude of the emperor and the Chinese authorities towards the mission, all factors which had a decisive influence on the mission's progress and expectations, of course. The relations with members of other religious congregations in China and with the ecclesiastical authorities in Rome, which from the end of the 17th century introduced the entire problem of the rights controversies, which would progressively take up more and more space in the letters. The learned topics also represent a large range of themes. Their own achievements in the very large field of Western mathematical science, for instance, be it magnetic measurements, geophysical, botanical or astronomical observations, or geographical cartographic operations. The manifold achievements in the domain of engineering in such various fields as hydraulics, construction of observational and musical instruments, and so on. The search, acquisition and circulation of Western books for at least 25% books on new findings and newly introduced instruments, but also new astronomical tables, mathematical textbooks, manuals on tools, and so on, all necessary sources to keep their scientific operations in China up to date, and all equally and urgently, if not desperately, sought for from China. Commentaries and questions on recently read books and articles. The sending of Sinica to European collections and collectors. Their own astronomical observations and other measurements. The results of their intense studies of Chinese classics and their commentaries. Chinese astronomical records and the annals, showing the Jesuits' great interest in calendar affairs and chronology, especially for its challenge to the traditional biblical chronology since at least Adam Charles von Bell in 1651. Some letter corpora, such as those of Ignatius Keuchler and Antoine Gobil, which I will discuss in more detail below, contain many real geleerdenbrieven, which in this sense are not different from the letters exchanged within the Respublica Literarum in Europe. Point 5. Some of the antecedents I previously described, I mean the main actors of the communication and the historical roots, give an indication as to where to look now for the main extant letter collections. Jesuit letters from China, both within and outside the society, were kept both in Jesuit and non-Jesuit collections. The pre-suppression Jesuit collections were, as a rule, after 1773, confiscated and publicly sold, and afterwards often fragmentized and diffused over several other, also private collections. Others were part of new public collections, most of them national libraries or national archives. The most substantial groups of Jesuit letters from China, therefore, thus ended up in such collections as in France, the Bibliothèque Nationale de France and the Observatoire de Paris, with papers once belonging to the correspondence from China with the Jesuit College Saint-Louis. In Bavaria, those papers arrived in the Bayerisches Hauptstaatsarchiv in Munich, with letters sent to the Jesuit College of München. In Italy, We have to look for them in the Biblioteca Nazionale Centrale Vittorio Emanuele in Rome, with a Fondo Gesuitico created since 1870 with materials from the former Jesuit Collegio Romano and the Domus Professa. In Portugal and Spain, the Ajuda Library in Lisboa and some collections in Madrid, which both preserve autographs and mid-18th century copies of letters from China to Macau and Europe and so on. In Belgium, a series of 5 public and private archives with the fragments of the correspondences of the Jesuit from China with the Bollandist fathers in Antwerp and several other smaller local collections. Yet, small parts of the old Jesuit archives are still or again in the possession of the new Society of Jesus, recreated since the third decade of the 19th century. This is the case, for instance, of the famous Fonds Brottier in the actual Archives de la Société de Jésus de France in Vanves, Paris, with autograph letters from China to Étienne Soucier. The correspondence with the general in Rome from the former Tabularium or Archivum Generale, which together with the Procurator's archives from the Collegio Romano constitutes now the core of the Archivum Romanum Societatis Jesu, established in 1930 with the fragments of the old collections, with itself an impressive collection of Japonica Sinica, among them a large series of Epistolae Sinenses and the letter corpora, the huge letter corpora in 4 volumes of Ferdinand Verbist and Antoine Thomas. Some China-related letters of Philippe Couplet are always in the Museum Bollandianum in Brussels and so on. For more information, more detailed information, I refer to my chapter on Western sources on the China mission in the first volume of the Handbook of Christianity in China, published by Brill in 2001, which needs an update anyway. But all this covers mainly the inter-Jesuit contacts within the Jesuit society itself. In addition, there were the outward-bound contacts with non-Jesuits, partially members of other religious congregations, but mostly lay scholars in Europe, either private persons or members of one of the national academic institutions, and of course with relatives. For obvious reasons, many autographed Jesuit letters are preserved in the archives of other congregations, as individual Jesuits were in contact with individual members of them. Jesuit letters, a large part of Jesuit letters, are therefore to be found in the collections of, for instance, the Missions Étrangères de Paris, Rue du Bac. Other congregational archives I have thus far not yet checked. The correspondence the Jesuits exchanged from China with the European academies can again be found in the historical academy collections or in the archives which keep the collections of these scholars. I refer especially to the letters the Jesuits sent from Beijing to the members of the Academia Imperialis in St. Petersburg, which represent an intense correspondence during some 30 years, between 1730 and 1760, and which are still preserved in the academic archives in St. Petersburg. I refer also to the correspondences from Beijing with the Royal Society and its successive secretaries in London, which are now in the British Library and, I suppose, also in the archives of the Royal Society. I refer also to the correspondence with the Paris academies and some of their secretaries, scholars, such as Nicolas Freire and Jean Dortus de Meyrin, largely preserved in the library of l'Observatoire de Paris, and especially in the late 18th century, the correspondence from China with the Ministre de l'État Henri Bertin and the Institut de France, completely preserved in the library of the same institute nowadays. As Portugal concerns, due to the great dispersion and systematic destruction of the Jesuit sources in the Pombal era, the contacts with Portuguese academies, in the first place the Academia Real da Historia Portuguesa, are only fragmentarily and indirectly known from external references. But these sufficiently prove how also this academy was involved in the shipment of new publications on the direct instigation of King João V, who often paid for them. These institutionalized contacts were important for the exchange of learned information and observational results and accompanied the exchange of books and instruments in both directions. Finally, of the letters from China sent to relatives and friends outside the official or professional circuits, most are lost, with the exception of the letters of von Hallerstein and sent by von Leinbeckhoven, which are kept in the extant family archives. But those who are preserved contain less information on scholarly themes anyway. In my sixth point, I will deal in short with the detailed presentation of some of the main correspondence. As a consequence of the foregoing observations, the most voluminous and far-ranging individual learned correspondence date from the 18th century. Especially then begins a more systematic, really learned correspondence in which not only achievements are narratively described or sources are mentioned or enumerated, but also questioned. These are particularly represented by the name already mentioned Ignaz Keugler and Antoine Goupil. The former, Keugler, the product of contemporary German mathematical instruction, especially in the Jesuit College of the Provincia Germania Superior, München as a center. The latter, Antoine Goupil, from the French academic world. Keugler, the coryphée of the so-called Portuguese, and Goupil of the parallel French mission, both sometimes opponents and occasionally also collaborators, who mutually exchanged books, manuscripts and information. To focus now for one moment on Keugler. Keugler had been a student of Nicasius Grammatici in Ingolstadt. When leaving for Peking, and also afterwards, he was supported by an entire network of fellow students of Grammatici and his own students, especially Eusebius Amort, Riederer, Schreier, Heinrich Hiss, Tiefenthaler, Gerstlager, and obviously, of course, the provincial procurators. These contacts led to a rich correspondence. In these letters, we find discussions on recently arrived tabulae, astronomical tables, especially the second edition of the Tabulae Ludovicianae of de La Hire, published in 1702, but also those of Giglieri, Halley, Manfredi, Pound, Street and Whiston. The book theme is prominently represented in this correspondence, both in reporting on the titles received and studied, especially Sturmius, Mathematica et Nucleata, L'Hôpital, Analyse des Infiniment Petit, François Noël, Observationes Mathematicae, again de La Hire, Tractatus Mechanicae, Amort, Systema Planetarium, de Theatrum Arithmetico Geometricum of Leopold, Flamsteed's Atlas Coelestis, Bianchino, Phenomena Veneris, the three volumes of Wolfius Elementa, Soustier's Observation Mathematique, John Kyle, Introductio ad Verum Astronomiam, and so on and so on. But also, we find that the description of titles of books they wanted to have and didn't have at that moment. Especially interesting is the overall influence of Newton, also visible in the circulation of Newton-inspired books and tables such as by Gregory, Grammatici, John Kyle, Pound, Street and so on. Also revealing in his correspondence are Keugler's critical reading and his detailed criticism, for instance, of François Noël's explanation of a series of aspects of the Chinese calendar, his criticism on some of Grammatici's astronomical texts, both published and in manuscript, of Gregory, and so on. All this reveals the active scientist astronomer who therefore was also very enthusiastic when he received all issues of the Histoire and the Mémoire de l'Académie des Sciences in Paris up to 1734, 32 volumes in all. His concern about keeping contact with the living scene of the European astronomy, especially in Germany, also appears from his attempt to get copies of Adel Bulnerius' Commercium Literarum, edited in Nuremberg and planned as a very correspondence blad for astronomers, but he only got acquaintance of the introductory volume, unfortunately. In addition, these letters inform us also on the external circumstances of this communication, and also the active intervention of the Portuguese king, his counselor Jean Baptiste Carbone, and so on. All in all, the support Keugler found was not only limited to German Central Europe, but included also France, Portugal, and especially also England. I suppose this may suffice to illustrate the contents of this learned correspondence from China to Europe. In his case, Keugler's case, speaking less of Chinese realities, but especially revealing for the circulation of scientific ideas and theories, books and tables from Europe to China, and the way these were assimilated by some Jesuit scholars in Beijing and made accessible and useful to the Chinese and the China mission. As Keugler's counterpart, I would present Antoine Goupil, active in Beijing as a scholar between 1722 and 1759, for a long period parallel with Keugler. His reconstructed correspondence with 342 letters from Goupil's own hand in the edition of René Simon of 1970 is a real gold mine for the history of science. The same themes as in Keugler's letters come to the fore: book supply, library formation, quest for books, commentaries, and so on. Compared with Keugler, a completely different field is added here, with reflections on Goupil's studies of Chinese classics, astronomical records, and so on, with a wealth of details on their interpretation in view of the problematic reconciliation with European data. This correspondence, which in the past has already received a lot of attention but has so far not been studied exhaustively, therefore has a much larger variety of aspects, really covering an entire life spent in scholarly activities. So I suppose it's time to come to my point 7, one last point, which I would like to stress here, namely concerning the impact of these correspondences on contemporary European readers. Not only the scholars, but also, to a lesser extent, the general public. The contents of these letters were integrated in the existing networks of communication, as many of their correspondents were commonly known members of the learned world with connections in most parts of Europe, and its impact was further ramified and prolonged through references, quotations, transcriptions and copies, demands for information or requests for books, and so on. Here I think, for instance, of the role Athanasius Kircher played as a transmitter and redistributor of information from China and other parts of the mission world over learned Europe, or the intermediary role of Leibniz as a collector and a dispatcher of information from and on China. The same role I can abundantly demonstrate for Etienne Soucier, librarian of the Jesuit College Saint-Louis in Paris, Nicolas Fréret of the Académie des Inscriptions et Belles Lettres, the mathematician Adamandus Kochanski in Poland, the astronomer Joseph Nicolas Delisle, and the physician Ribeiro Sanchez in St. Petersburg, and so on. As such, this correspondence from China appears not as an isolated phenomenon from some exotic exclave of the European Respublica Literarum, but rather as reliable information from the most advanced position of the same. The last stage in the circulation of these letters and their information is reached when they were published as separate items or as part of larger collections. Often this happened after a thorough polishing and stylistic refining, but also some screening and selection of the context, of the contents, which again may illustrate some intention to control the circulation of information on China, or at least on the China mission in Europe. In this way, one created collections such as the famous Duhalde's Description géographique, historique, chronologique, politique et physique de l'Empire de la Chine et de la Tartarie chinoise, in which the information of the letters was amalgamated into one current narrative text, and in others, like the Lettres Étifiantes et Curieuses and the Neue Weltbot. Or, at the end of the 18th century, the Memoirs concernant l'histoire, les sciences, les arts, les mœurs, les usages, etc. des Chinois, 16 volumes published in Paris between 1776 and 1814.
A last, not published narrative synthesis on Jesuit mission history in China, which largely relied on Jesuit correspondence from China, never published, is Dina and Spot, Collectanea Historica de Missione Sinensi. Now I come to my conclusions, very short. Our final assessment on the learned correspondence from China with Europe is clear. These correspondences were certainly the main link by which the Jesuits in China remained in contact with the developments in Europe as a necessary and quicker, more mobile complement to periodicals and books, which were felt as less convenient. For many aspects of the scientific activities, but also for their needs of updated information, the always repeated Nova and Recentissima, very often repeated in the letters, and for many original observations on the Chinese milieu in all its aspects, the letters are the most direct source of information. In addition, there are the treatises they compose themselves. Besides some exceptions, such as Johann Terentius, who died already in 1630, and some isolated items in the correspondences of other Jesuits, academic questions and acquaintances especially come to the fore in the letters from the late 17th, but the most professional, revealing and voluminous corpora date from the 18th century. Their information had a large distribution in Europe through copies and transcriptions, but especially because they were integrated also in other pre-existent and continent-spanning networks of correspondences, first those of the Jesuits, but also intersected with several others, like those of printers or individual scholars, like Athanasius Kircher, Leibniz, Koschansky, Moretus, and so on. Or because they were published or paraphrased in collected works. Learned correspondences also originated around the periodical procurators when in Europe. Anyway, the location of the extensive extant documents is due to the dispersion of the pre-1773 Jesuit collections, but also due to their unlimited writing and the great dispersion of their correspondence, not an easy job, for which some indications have been given here. They deserve a special job for which some indications have been given. They deserve a special place among the sources of the intellectual history of 17th, 18th century Europe, as they inform not only on the scholarly work of the Jesuits in China themselves, but especially on their sources, on the reception of European books, ideas and technology in the Far East. All this is in a myriad of details on editions, comments and so on. On the other hand, they also inform us on the spread of Sinica into private and public collections in Europe and the progressive building up of these collections. Despite all efforts made in the past, the detection phase of Jesuit correspondence from China actually kept in the European collections is by far not finished yet. Not only well-known collections were until recently not thoroughly investigated, but several historical archives, or archives with fragments of older collections, were not yet scrutinized. So this has to be continued, I suppose. Thank you for your attention.